Good evening, everybody. Happy Hanukkah to one and all Shmuel Plotzker coming at you live from my home at Goldman Synagogue and at School of Jewish Studies with a very special nightly shiur every Hanukkah night. And we're going to be reading from 1 Maccabees, which is from the Apocrypha. It's not from the biblical canon. Didn't make it in. It was not considered holy enough or written by Ruach HaKodesh with the Holy Spirit. And therefore, it did not make it into the canon of the Tanakh. I'll read a little bit from the Judaica, the Encyclopedia Judaica as to a little bit as to the background of it. First Maccabees is a historical work, extant in Greek, covering the period of 40 years from the accession of Antiochus Epiphanes, maybe pronounced Epiphanes in English, but in Greek it would be Epiphanes, and he came up to the throne in the year 175 before the Common Era, and then it tracks 40 years to the death of Shimon the Chashmonai, who passed in around the year 135 before the Common Era. Okay, its name in the Septuagint and in the writings of the Church Fathers, meaning Eusebius and Clement, is Tamakabaika, or Tamakabaika, Maccabean Matters, or the Book of the Maccabees. The original Hebrew name of the book is unknown. According to the Churchman Oregon, it was Sarbet Sabaniel. Different hypotheses have been suggested to explain these words, which should perhaps read, Sefer Beit Sarvanei Kel. And the word Sarvanei Kel, those who strive for God, being a translation into contemporary Mishnaic Hebrew of Yehoariv, the name of the priestly order to which the Chashmoni family belonged. So Oregon called it Sarbet Sabaniel. He was getting that out of the Hebrew, Sefer Bet. Okay, he makes Sefer Bet into Sarbet, and then Sarvanei Kel into Sabaniel. So that's not too far a stretch. All right? It's a historical source for the most part. Opens up with the conquest of Alexander the Great. We're going to see that in a minute. And then it goes straight into Antiochus Epiphanes and those Jewish Hellenizers who joined in with him. Okay? And it gives a very, very detailed account of the events of Matthias's revolt, all the way through the rededication of the temple, down to the time when Yochanan Hyrcanus, the eldest son of Shimon the Chashmonai, was appointed the ruler. And there are many biblical Hebrew forms which come up in the Greek. Words like Miyad Hagayim, from the hands of the Gentiles. Vayarom Libo, his heart was raised. Al Panav, before his face. Words like that do come up. Okay, and according to the Church Fathers, the original Hebrew, original language of the book was Hebrew. And the Psalm was biblical Hebrew. Particularly that of the historical works of the Bible. Guess what? Rabbi Stuart Lavender of Goffman Synagogue handed me a small little work last year. It is a Hebrew translation of many, but not all, many of the books of the Apocrypha, among them 1st and 2nd Maccabees. And who do you think translated this book into Hebrew? Well, it was none other than Zacharias Frankel, who was a very well-known, Moscow doesn't even begin to say it, I think. He was the forerunner of the conservative movement, one of the creators of the historical-critical approach to Judaism. And he decided to, apparently, got his hands on the Greek extant work that still is out there floating around in Greek, and he translated from the Greek back, if you will, back into the original biblical Hebrew. It's very clean, very lean. It's a nice Hebrew form, and he was able to do that because he was a master of these languages. He knew his Greek and his Latin and his Hebrew, so he was able to put the extant Greek form, originally written in Hebrew, now existing to us only in Greek, back in the mid-1800s, he put it into Hebrew again. And it was published by a German publishing company out of Berlin in 1927. I'm holding it in my hands right now. Okay, fascinating, small little work, and there's a lot there. So without further ado, there's a little bit more to be said about 1 Maccabees, but as far as I can recall, I've read, written by a nationalistic, observant Jew who was proud to be a Jew. He wrote it in Hebrew originally, and we have it today. Where do you find it? If you want to look up the apocryphal works, where would you find that? In a library, where you'd open up a Bible. Well, whose Bible would you open up? You'd open up a Roman Catholic Bible. You'd open up the Douay Rheims Bible. The Douay Rheims Bible is obviously out of the Catholic Church, and the Catholic Church historically felt that the books of the Apocrypha were holy enough to be included in their biblical canon. Along came the Protestants and said, no, I'll read you one little last paragraph here of the Encyclopedia Judaica. The original Hebrew version seems to have disappeared quite early. The Catholic Church, it just says the church, it's understood to mean the Catholic Church, included 1 Maccabees in its canon together with the rest of the Septuagint, and this was ratified by the Catholic Church Council of Trent. After the Reformation, the Protestants removed it from their Bible and relegated it to the Apocrypha. A Hebrew translation was made in the 11th century, and that was published by D. Trollson. There are so many sources in the bibliography regarding 1 Maccabees, but we're going to get right into it. Okay? So there was a Hebrew translation in the 11th century, and we have a much more recent one by Zacharias Frankel. I'd love to see what that 11th century translation looks like. At all events about the Reformation, one last thought, I said it over Shabbos table, the enemy of my enemy is my friend. The Reformation, the Protestants said, we've got these books, these intertestamental books written by Jews. How do the Jewish people feel about them? Answer, the Jews do not include those works in the Tanakh. They don't include the Ecclesiasticus and Esdras and 1st and 2nd Maccabees and Judith and Ben Sira and Baruch and the story of Susanna, which is an insane asylum story. There's so much to be said about these books, but the rabbis felt they weren't written with the Holy Spirit. So they were excluded from the canon of the Tanakh. But the Roman Catholic Church, probably as a way of spitting in the eyes of the Jews, they did include those very works into their biblical canon. Along came the Protestants, a thousand years later, if you will, and said, we're going to follow the Jews because we hate Rome. Whatever Rome says doesn't go with us. So if Rome says it's part of the canon, we say no, and we'll follow the Jews. So the Protestants and the Jews are together, effectively, on this one. When it comes to the apocryphal works, both Jews and Protestants relegate them to the apocryphal, the rubric of the apocryphal works, about 10 or 15 books that make up the Apocrypha, and 1st and 2nd Maccabees join those books. So without further ado, let's get right to it. Let's get into 1 Maccabees. I'm turning to my son's got a very beat up, but beautiful old little version of the Apocrypha. And so let's read the first book of the Maccabees. Chapter 1. And by the way, slightly archaic English. This is King's English, and we're going to eventually have to translate from the Shakespearean King Jamesian English into a little bit more contemporary English. I'll do that when I... either you let me know if you don't get it, or I'll just do it on my own when I realize that some of the language needs a little bit of updating. Chapter 1, what I'm going to do is I'm going to just kind of read it through without breaking it up verse by verse by verse. Just kind of read it in a narrative form, and as we see the need to translate from English to English, we'll do it. Funny, it's like in Hebrew, right? Ivrit b'Ivrit. When you're studying the Tanakh, you put it into modern contemporary Hebrew. Over here, Lahavdil and Tumult Tahar is the same thing. We're going to take this from this Shakespearean English and put it into more contemporary English. The first book of the Maccabees, chapter 1, verse 1. And it happened. And we're going to try to give a background as to the story of Hanukkah. And it happened after that Alexander, son of Philip the Macedonian, who came out of the land of Kittim, had smitten Darius, king of the Persians and Medes, that he reigned in his stead, the first over Greece. Nicely put, in a slightly more contemporary English. And so what happened to Alexander, son of Philip, he smote Darius, the king of the Persians and Medes. Okay, and so Alexander took over from Darius. Since Alexander beat down the Persians and the Medes, he displaced Darius. And instead of Darius, Dariavish, Alexander reigned in Darius' stead, and he became the first over Greece. He was the chief leader of Greece, obviously. And he made many wars, and he won many strongholds, and slew the kings of the earth. And he went through to the ends of the earth, and took spoils of many nations, insomuch that the earth was quiet before him. whereupon he was exalted, and his heart was lifted up. And he gathered a mighty strong host, and ruled over countries, and nations, and kings, who became tributaries unto him. And after these things he fell sick, and perceived that he should die. Wherefore he called his servants, such as were honorable, and had been brought up with him from his youth, and parted his kingdom among them, while he was yet alive. So Alexander reigned 12 years, and then died. And his servants bare rule every one in his place. And I would probably say in more contemporary English, they each one bore, B-O-R-E, bore rule, meaning to bear, to undertake, to hold up, to withstand, and to kind of prop up. He was bearing rulership. Each one of his servants became a ruler, each in his own place. And after his death, after Alexander's death, they all put crowns upon themselves. So did their sons after them many years. And evils were multiplied in the earth. See where the author is going right now, heading us right down over here, hinting to us that the successors were not as great as Alexander, who, as I said to my family, was fairly reasonable guy. I mean, as long as you paid him money, after he beat down your army and you paid him a tribute, he was happy because you were a source of income for him. Why would he ever want to, challenge that? You were a big pushka. So that was great. He was happy to be making money. And the fact that you may have worshipped certain gods, he just couldn't care because he had his own gods and you have your gods. Why would a pagan care? Now, things change. Things change very, very quickly and very much to the detriment of the Jews in the following verse. And there came out of them, remember, we're talking about the successors who all put crowns upon themselves. And so did their sons after them for many years. And evils were multiplied in the earth. Verse 10, and there came out of them a wicked root, Antiochus, surnamed Epiphanes, son of Antiochus the king, who had been a hostage at Rome. Excuse me. And he reigned in the 137th year of the kingdom of the Greeks. And I take that to mean, for a Jew writing that, that's the 137th year that the Greeks were in charge of the land of Israel. In those days, went there out of Israel wicked men who persuaded many, saying, let us go and make a covenant with the heathen that are round about us. For since we departed from them, we have had much sorrow. These are Jews who went out, wicked Jewish men who are persuading many other Jewish men, saying, let's make a treaty with the heathens, because ever since we departed from them, we've had a lot of sorrow. So this device pleased them well. I guess you would say in contemporary English, this advice pleased them well. Apparently, back in the day, the term may have been device. We use the term device, of course, to mean maybe some sort of machine of some sort. So this device pleased them well. But I'm learning that to mean advice. This advice pleased them well. Then certain of the people were so forward herein that they went to the king. They were so down with the program. They went to the king, Antiochus, who gave them license to do after the ordinances of the heathen. He told them, you've got permission to follow the pagans. Whereupon they built a place of exercise at Yerushalayim according to the customs of the heathens. They put up a big gym. And they made themselves uncircumcised. And they forsook the holy covenant. And they joined themselves to the heathen and were sold to do mischief, meaning they weren't sold into slavery. They were just, as we could say maybe today, they were sold on the idea. Oh, I'm not buying that. Oh, I'm sold. So over here, my understanding is when the English says this, they were sold to do mischief. It means they were very much given over. When you're sold, you belong to somebody else and you become his property. You are then fully his, to do it as he pleases. That's what happened over here. They were sold to do mischief. They became part and parcel of the pagan crowd. They forsook the holy covenant. They joined up with the heathens, and they were sold to do mischief. Now, when the kingdom was established before Antiochus, He thought to reign over Egypt, that he might have the dominion of two realms. Where is Antiochus sitting right now? I presume he's in Syria. That's why we call these people the Syrian Greeks. They were coming out of Syria, out of Damascus. And they were not coming out of Athens to rule Israel. Antiochus, as I recall, was a Seleucid, and the Seleucids were in Syria. And Antiochus belonged to that particular division of the empire. And ultimately, he's going to wind up declaring war on Egypt. That's the Ptolemaic division of the Greek empire. So you have the Seleucids in Syria. You have the Ptolemaites or the Ptolemites in Egypt. And the king of the Seleucids in Syria, Damascus, Syria, he wants to fight against Egypt and take that over. Okay? So he entered into when the kingdom was established before Antiochus. He thought to, well, meaning when he became fully ensconced as king in Syria, he thought to reign over Egypt, that he might have the dominion of two realms. He's going to try to be in charge of two countries, not just one. Wherefore he entered into Egypt with a great multitude, with chariots and elephants and horsemen and a great navy. And he made war against Ptolemy, king of Egypt. But Ptolemy was afraid of him and fled. And many were wounded to death. Thus they got the strong cities in the land of Egypt. And he, meaning Antiochus, took the spoils thereof. And after that, Antiochus had smitten Egypt, he returned again in the 143rd year of the Greek conquest of Israel. And he went up against Israel and Jerusalem with a great multitude. Now watch what happens over here. Question you have to have is, what exactly is making him do this? Is he upset at the Jewish people for anything at all? According to 1 Maccabees, no. The Jewish people are, some of them anyway, are Hellenizing. They're going along with the program. And they're telling their friends to go along with the program. He comes back, and listen to what he does. He returns, and he went up against Israel and Jerusalem with a great multitude. And he entered proudly into the sanctuary and took away the golden altar, the Mizbech HaZav, and the candlestick of light, the menorah. Okay? And all the vessels thereof. And the table of the showbread. We call that the Shulchan. We were learning about that in Chagiga. This is the Shulchan, where they put the showbread, where they put the lechem upon him.
So he was just thinking he was going after money.
He was going after all the vessels, right. Exactly. Yeah, he took away everything. He took took away the golden altar, he took away the menorah, and all the vessels thereof. Let's see. And he took away the table of the showbread, and the pouring vessels, and the vials, and the censers of gold, and the veil, and the crowns, and the golden ornaments that were before the temple, all which he pulled off. He's going after money. He took also the silver and the gold and the precious vessels. Also, he took the hidden treasures which he found. And when he had taken all away, he went into his own land, having made a great massacre and spoken very proudly. Therefore, there was great mourning in Israel, in every place where they were. Wow. According to this, he having made a great massacre, and the term massacre is only going to mean a loss of life. See, he stole a lot of stuff in the base of Mikdash, and presumably he killed a lot of Jews doing it. Thereupon there was great mourning in Israel. There's going to be great mourning, I'm sure, when you lose all the gold and silver in the base of Mikdash, but you're mourning a lot more when there's a loss of life. And it's just, I assume that's what happened over here. Therefore there was great mourning, mourning, availus in Israel, in every place where they were. So that the princes and elders mourned. The unmarried girls and young men were made feeble, and the beauty of women was changed, meaning their very composure was changed, their facial expressions changed. They went from being happy to being terribly sad. Every bridegroom took up lamentation, and she that sat in the marriage chamber was in heaviness. The land also was moved for the inhabitants thereof, and all the house of Jacob was covered with confusion. And after 2 years fully expired, the king sent his chief collector of tribute unto the cities of Judah, who came unto Jerusalem with a great multitude, and he spake peaceable words unto them. I love that term. He spake. Yeah, but we say he spoke. He spoke peaceful words to them, but all was deceit. All of it was a lie. For when they had given him credence, he fell suddenly upon the city and smote it very sore and destroyed much people of Israel. Mm-hmm. So they're getting very, very physical, very, very quickly with the Jews, and they are killing Jews. And when he had taken the spoils of the city, he set it on fire and pulled down the houses and walls thereof on every side, destroying people's homes. But the women and children, they took captive and possessed the cattle. They then built, we don't use the term builded in contemporary English. We just say, if you want to say past tense, you're going to say he or she or they built. They built the city of David with a great and strong wall and with mighty towers, and made it a stronghold for them, that is for themselves. And they put therein a sinful nation, wicked men, and fortified themselves therein. So the bad guys took over the city of David and Jerusalem, and they installed themselves. They put in these strongholds, mighty towers, so they could be for watchtowers for themselves and to lord over the people. Excuse me. Continuing with the text, they stored it also with armor and victuals, meaning weapons and food. And when they had gathered together the spoils of Jerusalem, they laid them up there. And so they became a sore snare. What does that mean? They stole the stuff from the Beis HaMikdash, and they didn't translate it back. They didn't yet ship it back to Damascus. Instead, they put, this is my understanding, they put the stuff from the Beis HaMikdash into a nearby citadel or tower that they themselves ran, a military tower, and they stored all the goodies from the Beis HaMikdash in there. And that was so offensive to the people to know that they had stolen the great things from the Beis HaMikdash, and they're just like 100 feet away, but this time they're either in a Greek temple, though I don't think that they're in a temple. It seems to me that they are building these citadels, these mighty towers, storing it up with armor and victuals. And the spoils of Yerushalayim they laid up there. And so they became a sore snare. When the word sore is used, it means very, very sorely. He is sorely missed. He is very, very missed. Okay? And a snare, of course, is like the term, Se'iva lo sitein michshol. Before a blind person, don't put a stumbling block. A stumbling block means something that's going to trip you up. Your tripwire. Okay? When you know somebody doesn't like you, you don't want that person to approach you. And you don't want to approach that person. Now, I'm not going to rule on these things. You have to, you know, hopefully figure them out and get back to a more normalized relationship. But a person who has a certain kind of an animus towards something or somebody, I was talking about it tonight with Rabbi Kunin and Yosef and his brothers. They were not able to speak peaceably to him. So Malvin, see the Malvin and Rav Hirsch, just to have to understand that. Their interpretation was, they could not tolerate. They couldn't stand it. They had no ability to assimilate his conversations with them. Dabro the Shalom. In his efforts to speak peaceably to them, they just couldn't bear it because they really, really resented him. They really didn't like him. Lo yachlu, stop, dabro le shalom. They just could not put up with it. Dabro le shalom. Yeah, maybe his words of peace. They just didn't want to hear his words of peace. Get out of here. We don't like it. So over here, this citadel filled with the stolen goods from the Beis HaMikdash became a sore snare. It became in their eyes a terrible, terrible, offensive thing. For it was a place to lie in wait against the sanctuary and an evil adversary to Israel. Thus they shed innocent blood on every side of the sanctuary and defiled it. I don't know if we get that story clearly enough in our, you know, more Talmudical, if you will, frumer versions of the Hanukkah story, it's not clear to me that we get the full picture of just how brutal this guy really was. He really, really was, and I haven't even gotten to the whole thing. I haven't even gotten to the other brutalities he's going to do. So he really was brutal, a real blood shedder. We just think, oh, he said no to Shabbos and Yontif and Rosh Chodesh and Bris Milah. It was far more than that. He was killing Jews. Well, let's think about it. Let's just keep reading and maybe it'll come to us. Okay, they shed innocent blood on every side of the sanctuary and defiled it. In so much equals to such an extent that the inhabitants of Yerushalayim fled because of them, whereupon the city was made a habitation of strangers and became strange to those that were born in her, and her own children left her. Jews were checking out of Yerushalayim left and right. They couldn't stand being in the city run by a bunch of pagans, and they had Jewish Hellenizing friends helping them out, and that's not a city that I know and love. That's not the Yerushalayim of gold that I know with the Beis HaMikdash. They trashed the Beis HaMikdash, stole everything out of it, defiled everything. They're killing Jews willy-nilly. I can't be in that city anymore. And they left. Verse 39. Her sanctuary was laid waste like a wilderness. It sounds like Lamentations. Her feasts were turned into mourning, her Sabbaths into reproach, her honor into contempt. As had been her glory, so was her dishonor increased. As great as she had been, Yerushalayim, so she became the other way, completely debased, paganized. And her excellency was turned into mourning. Moreover, King Antiochus wrote to his whole kingdom that all should be one people, and everyone should leave his laws. So all the heathen agreed according to the commandment of the king. All the pagans said, yeah, loving this guy. He's laying it down for everybody. We all have to be as one, and we're all going to have him as our king, and we're all going to leave alone our tribal laws and traditions that we are, you know, that we're accustomed to, and we're all going to jump on the Hellenizing bandwagon, and we're all going to be part of the Syrian Greeks, the Seleucid kingdom. That's what they're saying. That's what it says here. Okay, so all the heathens agreed according to the commandments of the king. How about the Jews? What do they say? Yea, many also of the Israelites consented to his religion and sacrificed unto idols and profaned the Sabbath. They went along with the program. Avodah Zarah, they got rid of Shabbos. For the king had sent letters by messengers unto Yerushalayim and the cities of Judah that they should follow the strange laws of the land. And they should also forbid burnt offerings and sacrifice and drink offerings in the Beis HaMikdash, in the temple. And that they should profane the Sabbaths and festival days and pollute the sanctuary and holy people. We're not done. They were also commanded, set up altars and groves, because groves is what they're all about. Pagans love to have like groves of trees in or near their houses of their temple, their pagan temples. I'll share with you. But we're not allowed to have that. Set up altars, he commanded, and groves, and chapels of idols, and sacrifice swine's flesh, and unclean beasts, that they should also leave their children uncircumcised, and make their souls abominable with all manner of uncleanness and profanation, to the end they might forget the law, and change all the ordinances. To what purpose all this? For what reason? What's the end game? It says it right there. To the end, meaning to the ultimate objective, that they should forget the Torah and change all the ordinances, meaning and change all the mitzvahs and not keep any of them. And whosoever would not do according to the commandment of the king, he said, he should die. In the selfsame manner wrote he to his whole kingdom, and appointed overseers over all the people, commanding the cities of Judah to sacrifice city by city. Then many of the people were gathered unto them, to wit, which is, of course, slightly old English, meaning, which is to say, i.e., id est in Latin, that is, id est, that is to say, and we In English today, you write down the letters IE. It's a Latin abbreviation. It is, that is, everyone that forsook the law. Let's read it again. Then many of the people were gathered unto them, unto these overseers of Antiochus, who are now commanding the cities of Judah. Then many of the people were gathered unto them, which is to say, everyone that forsook the law. All the people who were forsaking the Torah gathered to those Syrian Greek overseers of the cities of Judah. And so they committed evils in the land. Verse 53, and drove the Israelites into secret places, even wheresoever they could flee for Sukkah. Not sugar, not sukkah, not sukkar. Sukkah, probably sukkah, meaning, of course, it means help, for aid, assistance, and help. Sukkah. I may have pronounced it sukkah. I'm sorry about that. The word is probably properly pronounced sukkah. S-U-C-C-O-U-R. Okay? And they drove the Jews into secret places, even wheresoever they could flee, wherever they could possibly go for help. 54. Now watch this. Now the 15th day of the month Kislev, which of course is Kislev. So the 15th day of the month of Kislev, in the 140 and 50th year, they set up the abomination of desolation upon the altar, meaning one of the major gods of the Greek pantheon, the abomination of desolation upon the altar. And they built idol altars throughout the cities of Judah on every side. They were intent on building Bate Avodah Zarah everywhere they could. And they burnt incense at the doors of their houses and in the streets. And when I see that verse, my head flies right off my shoulders. They burnt incense at the doors of their houses and in the streets. Now, what does that tell you? You have to be in Israel to appreciate this. You have to have spent time in Israel. In Israel, how do they light the menorah?
Outside.
At the door. Literally at the door. So that on the right side is your mezuzah. On your left side is the menorah. It's in a box, a glass box. Therefore, it's unhit by the wind. The wind has no effect on it. It's surrounded by glass. It gets air as needed from a little window, maybe from the bottom, but it doesn't put out the fire. And so you've got these beautiful little menorahs on the left-hand side of every apartment building. This is on your right as you walk in, and a chanukiah, or what we call menorah, on the left, so that you're surrounded by mitzvahs as you enter the house. It's a beautiful thought. I like it, and it works for me. However, when I read this, I say, wait a second. Maybe this was the rabbinic way of being mesakein that. Maybe the rabbis instructed Jewish people, when you light the menorah, it should be a tikkun, a fixing for what was done back in the day. What was done back in the day? Quote, they burnt incense at the doors of their houses and in the streets. And I'm thinking this is a way to be mesakein the whole thing by burning lights of the Hanukkah menorah instead of the ugly, unkosher incense. They're now going to burn, they're going to light up the menorah lights and put that at the door. That's my little chiddush over here.
Wouldn't that destroy the homes?
You can be over here so I can hear you better.
Wouldn't that destroy the homes if they burn incense at the
doors? No, at the doors.
And also,
it won't burn down the house.
And also,
you just burn some incense at the door.
Were these the heathen Jews or were these non-Jews?
These were Jews who were becoming heathenized, Hellenized. And when they had rent in pieces the books of the law which they found, they tore in pieces the books of the Torah scrolls that they found. They burnt them with fire. These are Hellenizing Jews who were torching the Torah scrolls. And wheresoever was found with any, the book of the Testament, and in other words, whoever was found with a Torah scroll, wherever that may have been, or if any consented to the law, then you know if anybody believed in and kept the Torah, The king's commandment was that they should put him to death. Thus did they by their authority unto the Israelites every month, to as many as were found in the cities. Whoever was left in the cities who hadn't run away, they were torturing like this. Nobody can keep the Torah upon pain of death. Verse 59. Now, the 25th day of the month, they did sacrifice upon the idol altar, which is upon the altar of God. And bing, 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 there you have another one. And this is explicit. On the 25th day of the month of Kislev.
Today.
Right. What did they do back in the day, these Hellenizing Jews? Now, the 5th and 20th day of the month, they did sacrifice upon the idol altar, which was upon the altar of God. They had taken an altar, a pagan altar, placed it over the Mizbeach of God, and they began worshiping and sacrificing to their God, and they were slaughtering animals and burning them up on that paganistic altar. On what day? On the 25th day of the month of Kislev.
That's how it worked out,
and ever since then, again, it seems to me that was our beautiful opportunity. God gave us the ability to be misaken that very date by enabling the Jewish people on the 25th of Kislev to cleanse and re-sanctify the temple on that very day, the 25th of Kislev. Verse 60. At which time, according to the commandment, they put to death certain women that had caused their children to be circumcised. Those women who had their children gemalt, they killed the women.
What about the children?
And they hanged the infants about their necks. They took the infants and they hanged the little Jewish babies.
Why were they?
And rifled their houses, meaning, of course, as we know what that means. They ransacked, looking for loot, looking for money. They ransacked the houses. Jewish houses, and slew them that had been circumcised, and slew them that had circumcised them. They were killing mothers and fathers who were involved, who had allowed their children to go under bris milah. Howbeit, many in Israel were fully resolved and confirmed in themselves not to eat any unclean thing. However, says the author, many in Klal Yisrael were fully resolved and confirmed that they were not going to eat unclean meat, they were not going to eat these sacrifices, nothing. Wherefore they chose rather to die, that they might not be defiled with meats, and that they might not profane the holy covenant. So then they died. They preferred to die as Jews. They were not going to Hellenize. And there was very great wrath upon Israel. Presumably, it was coming from heaven above. There was very great anger upon the land of Israel and Klal Yisrael. That's what I get from that. That's the end of chapter 1. Wow. Now comes chapter 2. How much time do you guys have? Chapter 2 is going to take a little bit of time. So you know what I'm going to let you do? I'm going to let you guys go. God willing, we will start promptly tomorrow night at 6:30, and I'll keep out the first Maccabees background. You can Google it. You can see it in Encyclopedia Judaica. And with God's help, we'll just get right to the chase, and we'll do chapters 2 and hopefully chapter 3 tomorrow. Try to hop a rein and try to keep ourselves on a straight and narrow. It's hard to do. I mean, this is a very, very long chapter. There's nothing we can do about it. Next chapter, chapter 2, is 70 verses. It's a long one. So I'll let you guys go and enjoy the rest of the evening, the holiday. Enjoy the beautiful lights. Your Hanukkah should be enjoyable. Hot latkes, sufganiyot, dreidel games, gifts if you're exchanging them. Enjoy in the very best of health. Thank you all very, very much for joining us over here on opening night, a Hanukkah night here, December 18th, 2022. And hopefully everybody's going to enjoy the holiday. We'll see everybody tomorrow night again at 6:30. For those of you who join us at our Gofman Synagogue School of Jewish Studies, we're on at 10:30 for Moed Katan, Mishnayos Moed Katan in the first chapter. And then, of course, book club class. We're still doing show. We're still within the Book of Majesty of Rosh Hashanah, slowly wrapping it up. Remember, with Menemta Smith, you take it with you. It seems so far away. We're in Hanukkah now. Rosh Hashanah was a long time ago, but we're still basking in the glow of Rosh Hashanah. Wishing everybody a very happy Hanukkah. See you tomorrow at 10:30 for our class in Intro to Talmud 101. We continue with Moed Katan, first chapter, the Mishnayos, the first chapter, 1 o'clock book club class, and then, of course, 6:30 once again for First Maccabees. Everybody have a great holiday. Take care and be well. Enjoy wherever you go. Enjoy your parties in the best of health. Stay safe. Bye right now.